Okay, so I guess we can start. So this sutta for today is known as the Devadaha Sutta, Majjhima Nikaya 101. Has everybody got a copy of the sutta? Everybody? Yeah? Have you got any more copies, Lynn? Yeah? So if you need a copy of the sutta, Lynn has them at the back there. Yeah. Okay, so this sutta describes, in a sense, an encounter between the Buddha and some Jain ascetics. And this, in a sense, is the Buddhist criticism of these Jain ascetics and why the, at the same time formulating why the Buddhist path actually works and why, according to Buddhism, the Jain path has at least certain limitations. So this is what this is basically about. So we'll just... Let's go for it, see what happens as we go along here. Thus have I heard. On one occasion, the Blessed One was living in the Sakyan country, where there was a town of the Sakyans named Devadaha. There the Blessed One addressed the bhikkhus thus. Bhikkhus, Venerable Sir, they replied, and the Blessed One said this. Bhikkhus, there are some recluses and Brahmins who hold such a doctrine and view as this. Whatever this person feels, whether pleasure, pain, or neither pain nor pleasure, all that is caused by what was done in the past. So, by annihilating with asceticism past actions, and by doing no fresh actions, there will be no consequences in the future. With no consequences in the future, there is the destruction of action. With the destruction of action, there is the destruction of suffering. With the destruction of suffering, there is destruction of feeling. With the destruction of feeling, all suffering will be exhausted. So speak the Nigantas, bhikkhus. So this is here said to be the view of the Nigantas. The Nigantas are the Jains. These are the Jain ascetics. The Jain ascetics is this sect in India, if you don't know, that started just before Buddhism, and it's the, one of the few sects that exist in that day that still exists in India to the present day. So you still find these Jain ascetics in India to this present day. Some of these Jain ascetics are naked ascetics; they wander around completely naked, basically. And this is then said to be one of their doctrines. And part of this is whatever this person feels, whatever kind of feelings you have, all that is caused by what was done in the past. And elsewhere in the suttas, the Buddha says that if that is your view, and if that was the reality, if it actually was like that, there would be no way of actually making an end of suffering in this life. We couldn't actually practice the path to an end of suffering if that was the reality, that everything you feel and experience was caused by past actions. Because if everything you experience is caused by past actions, there isn't really any scope for changing that and to experience new things, at least in this present life, because everything is already set in concrete due to the past. So this idea is not the Buddhist idea. And you have to be careful here, because sometimes in Buddhist circles you will often hear people saying things like, when you experience something bad, you say, oh yeah, it's my bad karma, right? It's kind of the standard kind of explication of anything bad that happens to you in life. Oh, it's my karma. And sometimes people actually believe that quite literally, that everything that happens to them is due to some karma in the past. And that actually is not the way the Buddha taught the doctrine of karma. It just doesn't work like that. And the Buddha says that there are many things that are the causes for what we feel in ordinary life during the course of a day. There's lots of reasons for the various feelings that we have. And karma is only one out of a number of possible causes or conditions that are responsible for what we feel. And most of the things we feel are just the kind of the vicissitudes or the kind of things that happen during the day, right? We stumble somewhere, or we, you know, whatever happens during the daily life. All of these things are just caused by whatever happens during daily life. And it's nothing to do with karma. So the Buddhist idea of karma is mainly to do with rebirth. You get reborn in a certain realm due to past conditions. But once you actually kind of are stuck in that realm for that life, then the range of things that you experience there are themselves not very rarely due to specific karma. They're just due to the fact that you have been reborn in the human realm. So don't blame things on karma. That's basically kind of the thing here. So this is the difference here between the Buddhist view and the Jain view. The Jains, at least some of these Jains, seem to have the point that everything you experience is due to past actions. And then you have this elaborate thing here that by annihilating with asceticism past actions, this is where the Jains get this idea that you torture yourself, right? You torture yourself. So then by torturing yourself, it's like you're forcing these actions to ripen that you've done in the past. And by forcing them to ripen, you are annihilating all these actions that cause you to be reborn and continue in samsara in the future. So you torture yourself, and then by doing that, you are annihilating all the actions of the past, and then you don't do any fresh actions. Right? I'm not sure exactly how that is supposed to work, how you don't do any fresh actions, but anyway. And then there's no consequences for the future, presumably means that you don't get reborn in the future. And because of that, all suffering comes to an end. I'm not sure if I really understand exactly the import or the point of this Jain ideas here. It's a bit kind of vague to me what exactly is going on. But it doesn't really matter. This is just a Buddhist presentation of the Jain view. Yes, who it was? Yeah.
Was the Buddha, trying out this idea?
That's a very good question. And that, I think, is many people have kind of come to that conclusion that the Buddha may have been practicing like Jainism, in a sense, or at least following similar ideas as the Jains during that time. And there is, a sutta, I think the Majjhima 85 or something like that, where the Buddha actually says that prior to his awakening, he had wrong view, right? Just like everybody else. And because he had wrong view, he did things that weren't going to lead to the end of suffering. So he was doing this kind of thing. So yes, it seems like he was, if it wasn't the Jain, at least he was following Jain ideas pretty much.
Because at that time, as I understand, the Jainism is the mainstream. It's one of the mainstream ideas.
Yeah, yeah. And it seems that it existed prior to Buddha, isn't it? So it was around, so he would very likely have tried some of those things out. Yeah, that is true. Okay, so let us move on. So this is the view, and then this is what the Buddha did next. I go to the Nigantas who speak thus, and I say, "Friend Nigantas, is it true that you hold such a doctrine and view as this? Whatever this person feels, etc., etc., all suffering will be exhausted. If, when they are asked thus, the Nigantas admit this and say yes, then I say to them." So the first things you will notice here, that this is what something the Buddha always does. He doesn't just assume that what he has heard is true. He always goes up, first of all, and says, well, is it true that this is what you say, right? So that they have a chance to kind of rectify if there is any problem there. And that's obviously a nice thing and an appropriate thing to do. So then, if they agree, then this is what the Buddha says. But friends, do you know that you existed in the past and that it is not the case that you did not exist? No, friend. But friends, do you know that you did evil actions in the past and did not abstain from them? No, friend. But friends, do you know that you did such and such evil actions? No, friend. But friends, do you know that so much suffering has already been exhausted, and that so much suffering has still to be exhausted, or that when so much suffering has been exhausted, all suffering will have been exhausted? No, friend. But friends, do you know what the abandoning of the unwholesome states is, and what the cultivation of wholesome states is here and now? No, friend. So we can see here that it's problematic, this doctrine, right? Because they don't really know what they're doing. They're kind of doing something blindly, and this is the problem here. And of course, this is what the Buddha would point out next. But one of the little points here, which is interesting, of course, is this: the first question here, where he says that, do you know that you existed in the past, and that it is not the case that you did not exist? And again, this again shows us, as you find many places in the suttas, that it was not always an accepted idea at the time of the Buddha that everybody, this idea of rebirth was not something that was absolutely established in society. If it was absolutely established and it was a view of everybody, then this question wouldn't really make any sense, right? So that when they admit that they know they didn't exist, it means that that was a possibility at that time. So again, it undermines this idea which is often held by people that the Buddha just took on the view of the times that there was rebirth and followed that as a consequence. He just took on the culture of the times. He didn't, because the culture of the times wasn't that fixed. It was a time when there was lots of questioning and many different ideas about these things in India, at least, or the north of India. Yes?
I thought that Jains hold the idea of rebirth.
Yes.
And I thought that based on that question itself, is whether that practitioner actually could regress and see his own rebirth.
Right. True. That's probably what it means. It may mean that you don't actually know that, but I think the very fact that you admit that you don't know also means that there is an openness to the answer. I think they probably go together. But that is true. That it might just be a reference to knowledge rather than to a kind of whether that. But yeah, at least I admit that it's faith-based, right? At the very least. Okay. So anyway, so they accept that they don't know very much about these about what's happening. So then the Buddha says, "So friends, it seems that you do not know that you existed in the past, and that it is not the case that you did not exist, or that you did evil actions in the past and did not abstain from them, or that you did such and such evil actions, or that so much suffering has already been exhausted, and that so much suffering has still to be exhausted, or that when so much suffering has been exhausted, all suffering will have been exhausted, or what the abandoning of unwholesome states is, and what the cultivation of wholesome states is here and now. That being so, it is not fitting for the Venerable Nigantas to declare, whatever this person feels, whether pleasure or pain, or neither pain nor pleasure, all that is caused by what was done in the past. So by annihilating with asceticism past actions, and by doing no fresh actions, there will be no consequences in the future. With no consequences in the future, etc. Oops. All suffering will be exhausted. So this is the. So here he's pointing out that there is no inconsistent, right? The idea, if you don't understand what you're doing, and then you're following a practice based on not understanding what you're doing, well, then there is no basis for that the whole thing here. And this is what the Buddha is pointing out here. Okay, let's look at one more paragraph here. If, friend Nigantas, you knew that you existed in the past, and that it is not the case that you did not exist, or that you did evil actions in the past and did not abstain from them, or that you did such and such evil actions, or that so much suffering has already been exhausted, or that so much suffering has still to be exhausted, or that when so much suffering has been exhausted, all suffering will have been exhausted, or what the abandoning of unwholesome states is, and what the cultivation of wholesome states is here and now, that being so, it would be fitting for the Venerable Nigantas to declare what they are declaring here. Yes?
If you don't be aware of the things that you have done in the past that have caused you grief, then when you come into another life,
yeah.
You will repeat those
yeah.
again. So with what is written down here, how does that correlate with all exhausted? Because, you know, sometimes you can just keep on repeating.
Yeah, well, the idea here is that rebirth is caused by past actions, right? So if by annihilating all the things that cause rebirth, that's the idea, you annihilate all the stuff that causes rebirth.
But you have to become aware of that, don't you?
Well, I think it's just, this is just a doctrine, I think. This is just an idea, a doctrine that they hold. They have this doctrine, you know, for them, I don't know if they, what they think about awareness, maybe from Buddhist point of view, yes. But from their point of view, it's just a doctrine, it's just an idea. And the idea is that if we annihilate all that, then we'll be finished with samsara. So it's not really, they're just following a teaching, you know, propounded by this, the leader of the Jains. Yeah. So, yeah, just one little thing here. That being so, it would be fitting. I think that is not perhaps the best translation. It's better to say, that being so, it might be fitting for the Venerable Nigantas to declare. Because even if all that is true, it still isn't necessarily the case that the doctrine or the teaching of the Nigantas is actually appropriate or correct, even if all those things actually are true. So might be is probably the best translation in that particular case. So, does that make sense, everyone, what's going on here? Are you happy with that? Yeah? Okay. So, let's just go on. It's quite a long sutta. I'm going to go a little bit faster than usual. Friend Niganta, suppose a man were wounded by an arrow thickly smeared with poison, and because of this he felt painful, racking, piercing feelings. Then his friends and companions, kinsmen and relatives brought a surgeon. The surgeon would cut around the opening of the wound with a knife, probe for the arrow with a probe, pull out the arrow, and apply a medicinal cauterizer to the opening of the wound. And at each step, the man would feel painful, racking, piercing feelings. Then, on a later occasion, when the wound was healed and covered with skin, the man would be well and happy, independent, master of himself, able to go where he likes. He might think, formerly I was pierced by an arrow thickly smeared with poison, and because of this I felt painful, racking, piercing feelings. Then my friends and companions, kinsmen and relatives brought a surgeon. The surgeon cut around the opening of the wound with a knife, probed for the arrow with a probe, pulled out the arrow, and applied a medicinal cauterizer to the opening of the wound. And at each step I felt painful, racking, piercing feeling. But now that the wound is healed and covered with skin, I am well and happy, independent, my own master, able to go where I like. So too, friends Nigantas, if you knew that you'd existed in the past, if you knew all these things that they have been talking about, that being so, it might be fitting for the Nigantas to declare, whatever this person feels, etc., all suffering will be exhausted. In other words, the point the Buddha is making here is that the simile here is a point that you have to actually experience that this works, right? If you can see that there is bringing in the surgeon, you go through a series of steps, and then the series of steps lead to you being healed of the suffering, well, then you know that it actually has worked, right? And in the same way, if the Nigantas could actually see that their karma was being exhausted, could see that there's only so much karma left, and eventually the whole thing gets exhausted. If you can see that, then it is appropriate to declare what they are declaring. So the Buddha is basically pointing out that they're doing something blindly, right? They don't know what's going on. And that is the problem with this particular Jhana practice here, according to the Buddha. Okay, and then the Buddha says, but since, friend Nigantas, you do not know that you existed in the past, and that it is not case that you do not exist, etc., etc., because of that, it is not fitting for the Venerable Nigantas to declare, whatever this person feels, etc., all suffering will be exhausted. Then the Nigantas reply. So when this was said, the Nigantas, the Jains, told me, friend, the Niganta Nataputta, Nagantavata Buddha is the leader of the Jains, otherwise known as Mahavira in the Jain literature. Mahavira means great sage. Friend, the Nagantanata Buddha is omniscient and all-seeing and claims to have complete knowledge and vision thus. Whether I am walking or standing or asleep or awake, knowledge and vision are continuously and uninterruptedly present to me. He says thus, Nigantas, you have done evil actions in the past. Exhaust them with the performance of piercing austerities. And when you are here and now restrained in body, speech and mind, that is doing no evil actions for the future. So by annihilating with asceticism past actions, and by doing no fresh actions, there will be no consequences in the future. With no consequence in the future, etc., all suffering will be exhausted. We approve of and accept this, and so we are satisfied. So this is, you can see here where they're coming from. They're coming from faith, right, or confidence in this person. So it's like, so basically it's based on faith. So the Buddha then responds to them. When this was said, I told the Nigantas, there are five things, friend Nigantas, that may turn out in two different ways here and now. What are these five? They are faith or confidence, approval, oral tradition, reasoned cogitation, and reflective acceptance of a view. These five things may turn out in two different ways here and now. Herein, what kind of faith do the Venerable Nigantas have in a teacher who speaks about the past? What kind of approval? What kind of oral tradition? What kind of reasoned cogitation? What kind of reflective acceptance of a view? Speaking thus, bhikkhus, I did not see any legitimate defense of their position by the Nigantas. So I will explain to you what is going on here. So what is going on here is that the Buddha says that there are two different outcomes of this way of thinking. And two different ways, it means that either it is true or it is false. That is basically two different outcomes, right? So either it is true, what you have faith or confidence in, what you approve, what has come down in an oral tradition, what you have reflected over, right? Reason, cogitation means reflection, and whatever view that you have accepted after thinking about it. It can either be true or it can be wrong. This is what the Buddha is saying. And then he says, then he asks the Nigantas, well, you know, whatever reason you have for having confidence in the Nigantanata Buddha, in this Mahavira, what is that reason for having faith in him? What are your grounds for placing faith in this person? Or for having approving of the tradition? Or for having reflective acceptance of the view? Whatever it is that you are going back to, why do you have that? In other words, all of these things need to be backed up, right? Because they can go either one way or the other one, they have to be backed up with some sort of reason. This is what the Buddha is saying here. So what do you back up your confidence with? Why do you have confidence in this? And then he says here that, I did not see any legitimate defense of their position. In other words, when they tried to explain why they had faith and confidence in the Mahavira, Nigantanata Buddha, they weren't really able to come up with a convincing answer for why they should have that faith and confidence. So this is what the Buddha is saying here. And of course, in Buddhism, the Buddha does actually sometimes give reasons for why you can have confidence in somebody, right? There must be certain qualities that you can observe in the person. It's always based on your own ability to judge the other person. And when you see those qualities, or when you see certain behaviors, that is when faith and confidence is appropriate. And if they haven't gotten that, well, then that faith will be often wrongly placed. Yes, sir. Who are you talking? Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, that's good. You get lots of exercise here, don't you, running around here?
These five factors seem to be all encompassing. Because especially the last two. I mean, this is what we hold up as science. I mean, logic and repeated experimentations.
Yeah.
I mean, even massive experimentations.
Yeah.
But it seems as if the Buddha is saying the ultimate test is a direct knowledge.
I think what he's saying here is that the ultimate test, of course, is direct knowledge, but you have to start somewhere else. You have to start somewhere more, kind of more basic than ultimate knowledge.
Confidence and so on.
Yeah, but even that confidence and even that reflection has to be wisely done, right? So everything has to be wisely done from the beginning here.
Yeah, because even, I mean, as we know, even repeated massive experimentation may simply be a special case.
Yes, exactly. So there, so indeed. But I mean, of course, the more experiments you have, the more kind of certain you can be of a certain theory, of scientific theory, or whatever it is, right? The more kind of, the more often it is repeated, you know, repeated by others, the more confidence you can have in that particular theory, whatever it is.
Because I mean, with this kind of these five factors, especially the last two, I mean, the ground is that there's no absolute theory. That there's an ever increasing refinement of one or more theories, but the Buddha never definitely holds that that's not true. There's an ultimate position.
Right. Yeah. This is the thing. Yeah. And I mean, there are other places in the suttas where the Buddha says that even things like, you know, something can be thought out very carefully and look very logically very correct, but because it is often sometimes based on the wrong assumption, it still falls. Or sometimes something can be thought out very badly. It can be really badly reasoned, but because it is, for some reason, it can still turn out actually to be right. So you have to. So he's actually pointing out the limits of thinking as well, the thinking mind, and especially the Buddhist point of view, because from the Buddhist point of view, there are distortion at the very root of our perception of the world. And because the distortions are there, it is very easy to go wrong even with your thinking mind. So that makes it often very hard to, you know, to be certain about things. Okay. Everybody happy with that? Yeah? Okay. We are paragraph 12, if you are. Yeah, paragraph 12, yeah. So that's where we're starting now. Okay, so then the Buddha goes on. So first of all, he cannot see any legitimate defense of the position of the Jains. He cannot see any reason why they should take that faith, that confidence in their leader. Again, bhikkhus, I said to the Nigantas, what do you think, friend Nigantas, when there is intense exertion, intense striving, do you then feel painful, racking, piercing feelings due to intense exertion? But when there is no intense exertion, no intense striving, do you then not feel any painful, racking, piercing feelings due to intense exertion? And then they say that when there is intense exertion, friend Gautama, intense striving, then we do feel painful, racking, piercing feelings due to intense exertion. But when there is no intense exertion, no intense striving, then we do not feel any painful, racking, piercing feelings due to intense exertion. So the Buddha is just saying, well, perhaps the reason why you feel so much pain has got nothing to do with past karma. It's because you are taking it on yourself, right? You are sitting on hot rocks all day, standing on one leg, you know, for hours or days or years at the time. Of course it's going to be painful. It may have absolutely nothing to do with past actions. So this is, again, the kind of the very pragmatic Buddhist view of the world. What is the obvious cause for something? That also tends to be the cause for why something is happening. So if you put yourself in kind of in such a position, of course you're going to feel pain. So it seems, friend Nigantas, that when there is intense exertion, well, then you feel painful, racking, piercing feelings. But when there's no intense exertion, you don't feel those painful feelings. That being so, it is not fitting for the Venerable Nigantas to declare whatever this person feels, whatever pleasure, pain, and neither pleasure, pain, all that is caused by what was done in the past, etc., etc. If, friend Nigantas, when there was intense exertion, intense striving, then painful, racking, piercing feelings due to intense exertion were present, and when there was no intense exertion, no intense driving, then painful, racking, piercing, feeling due to intense exertion were still present. That being so, it would be fitting for the Nigantas to declare whatever this person feels is due to past actions, right? So in other words, if they felt the suffering regardless of what they did, whether they exert themselves or not, well then it would be fitting to say that it was due to past actions, because it was something they couldn't do anything about, right? It was just due to past actions happening. And then he repeats the same thing again. But since, friend Nigantas, when there is intense exertion, intense driving, that is when you feel the pain. But when there is no intense exertion, you don't feel the pain. You are therefore feeling only painful, racking, piercing feelings of your self-imposed exertion. And it is through ignorance, unknowing and delusion that you mistakenly hold whatever this person feels, etc., all suffering will be exhausted. Speaking thus, speakers, I did not see any legitimate defense of their position by the Nigantas. Again, speakers, I said to the Nigantas, what do you think, friend Nigantas? Is it possible that an action whose result is to be experienced here and now can, through exertion and striving, become one whose result is to be experienced in the next life? No, friend. But is it possible that an action whose result is to be experienced in the next life can, through exertion and striving, become one whose result is to be experienced here and now? No, friend. So, he's pointing out here that there are actions have a different kind of they mature at different times. Some actions are to be experienced in this life. Some actions are to be experienced in a future life, right? Now, if you are going to destroy all actions by experiencing pain here and now, but that action is due to be experienced in a future life, then of course that becomes impossible. This is the point here he's making here. And because they don't know, then again, there's a blindness at the root of their striving here. What do you think, friend Nigantas? What do you think, friend Nigantas? Is it possible that an action whose result is to be experienced as pleasant can, through exertion and striving, become one whose result is to be experienced as painful? No, friend. But is it possible that an action whose result is to be experienced as painful can, through exertion and striving, become one whose result is to be experienced as pleasant? No, friend. So remember here, the point here of the Nigantas, of these Jains, is that they want to exhaust all action through experiencing pain, right? But what about if some of those actions they have done in the past will result in happiness in the future? Can you exhaust those actions that are supposed to result in happiness by striving through and giving rise to pain? And the answer he's pointing out, it doesn't make any sense. If all they do is just striving through pain, they will never be able to exhaust those actions that are supposed to be have a result in the happiness in the future. So again, he's showing the inconsistency of what they're doing. They don't really know what they're doing. What do you think, friend Nigantas? Is it possible that an action whose result is to be experienced? There's a slight translation problem here. It's to be experienced when it is matured. Can, by exertion and striving, become one that is to be experienced when it's not matured? No, friend, but is it possible an action whose result is to be experienced when it is not matured, can, by exertion and striving, become one whose result is to be experienced when it is matured? No, friend. So in other words, there are certain actions that haven't matured yet, right? They're not ready to be experienced. And because they haven't matured yet, because they're not ready to be experienced, you cannot force them to be experienced. That's the point here again. It's similar to what we were looking at before with the idea of whether they can be experienced in the present life if they're supposed to be experienced in the future life. All of this is just showing that karma is a very kind of complex thing, and unless you understand what's going on, you're just fumbling in the dark. You don't know what you're doing. What do you think, friend Agantas? Is it possible that an action whose result is to be much experienced can, through exertion and striving, become ones whose result is to be experienced only a little? No, friend. But is it possible that an action whose result is to be little experienced through exertion and striving can be one whose result is to be much experienced? And again, you know, the question here is, well, how much do you need? How much pain and suffering do you need to experience a certain action? Do you know that this is enough pain and experience that you're having to annihilate these actions? Or do you need more? Or do you need less? Again, there's all this uncertainty around this. What do you think, friend Nigantas? Is it possible that an action whose result is to be experienced can, through exertion and striving, become one whose result is not to be experienced? No, friend. But is it possible that an action whose result is not to be experienced can, through exertion and striving, become one whose result is to be experienced? No, friend. Not entirely sure what that last one is about, to be honest. But, yeah.
It seems that there's an underlying tone that is taken to be true for granted by people of that age. Because as far as I'm concerned, many of those questions, who knows, maybe, who knows whether it's yes or no.
I think the point is just that, you know, to be able to deal with karma, you have to have an understanding of the laws of karma. Yeah. And the Buddha is saying, well, the laws of karma, you know, I don't think necessarily the Buddha is saying that this is the way the laws of karma operate, but he's saying that there's a vast different ways they could operate. And if you don't understand the laws, well, you're actually, again, you're just going into the darkness, and you're assuming a lot of things without really knowing what's going on here.
Yeah, because the answer was a definite no. So there's some knowledge there that this is not possible.
The Buddha is just saying that... the answer is a definite no. That's true. Huh? But I think the point that it might just be a hypothetical question, right? It may not be a question that is, well, you don't know. I mean, this is the way it could be looked at in this way. And if that was the case, well, then it wouldn't work out. So because the Nigantas don't know what they're doing, then it's hypothetically possible that the world operates in a different way from what they're thinking. Yeah? Mm-hmm. So that's why it is a no there. Huh? Uh-huh. Yeah.
Because I was saying that an answer to, suppose this is brought forward to now, among intelligentsia, I mean, this is posed forward, it will be a maybe, you know, it needs experimentation.
Yeah.
And one would try ways and means to design experiments.
Indeed. I think the point is that nobody knows, you know, the Buddha is saying, well, you guys don't know what you're doing. That's what he's saying. This is, you know, many different ways this could be. From the Buddha's point of view, he may know. He doesn't know what's going on.
I would
but,
take this as a Buddhist position.
But not necessarily the case. It just depends. I mean, there may be certain things you can't know about karma, right? It may be so complex you can't really say. May not be an answer to all of these things.
Yeah,
but still, there's the underlying uncertainty there. Huh? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. And then the Buddha, again, he just summarizes the whole thing. So the next paragraph here is just a summary of all these things. So it seems, friend Nigantha, that it is impossible that an action whose result is to be experienced here now can, through exertion and striving, become one whose result is to be experienced in the next life. And impossible that an action whose result is to be experienced in the next life, through exertion and striving, become one whose result is to be experienced here and now. Impossible that an action whose result is to be experienced as pleasant can, through action and striving, become one whose result is to be experienced as painful. And impossible that an action whose result is to be experienced as painful can, through exertion and striving, become one whose result is to be experienced as pleasant, etc., etc. He's just going through everything, just recapping on what he has said before. And then, at the very end of this paragraph, he then says, well, that being so, the Venerable Nigantas' exertion is fruitless. Their striving is fruitless. So that being so, in other words, assuming that is so, well then the striving of the the Nigantas, the Jains, has no fruit. They are just striving in an aimless, aimless manner here. So speak the Nigantas, bhikkhus, and because the Nigantas speak thus, there are 10 legitimate deductions from their assertions that provide ground for censuring them. So he's saying that because of this, they can be criticized in these 10 ways. If the pleasure and pain that beings feel are caused by what was done in the past, then the Nigantas surely must have done bad deeds in the past, since they now feel such painful, racking, piercing feelings. So that's the first ground. So, you know, if they, at the very least, then it can be criticized for having done lots of bad things in the past, because now they're suffering so much. If the pleasure and pain that beings feel are caused by the creative act of a supreme god, then Nigantas surely must have been created by an evil supreme god, since they now feel such painful, racking, piercing feelings. If the pleasure and pain that beings feel are caused by circumstance and nature, then the Nigantas surely must have bad luck, since they now feel such painful, racking, piercing feelings. If the pleasure and pain that beings feel are caused by class, in other words, different types of rebirth, or different belonging to different classes perhaps, then the Nigantas surely must belong to a bad class, since they now feel such painful, racking, piercing feelings. If the pleasure and pain that beings feel are caused by exertion here and now, the Nigantas surely must strive badly here and now, since they now feel such painful, racking, piercing feelings. And of course, it's the last position here, which is the Buddhist, how the Buddhist would really criticize the Jains, because they are just striving in a way which is fruitless and is causing lots of pain. If the pleasure and pain that beings feel are caused by what was done in the past, then the Nigantas are to be censured. If not, the Nigantas are still to be censured. In other words, either way, it doesn't work out. If it was by what was done in the past, then they are censured for the fact that they must have done something bad in the past, right? And if not, if that wasn't the case, well, they are censured then for striving in a manner which is not going to give the results they're trying to get anyway. So either way, they are censured. If the pleasure and pain that beings feel are caused by the creative act of a supreme god, then the Nigantas are to be censured. If not, they are still to be censured. If the pleasure and pain that beings feel are caused by chance, then the Nigantas are to be censured. If not, they are still to be censured. If the pleasure and pain that beings feel are caused by class, then the Nigantas are to be censured. If not, they are still to be censured. If the pleasure and pain that beings feel are caused by exertion here and now, then the Nigantas are to be censured. And if not, they are still to be censured. So basically, the Buddha is saying that what they are doing, that's what it comes down to, regardless of the kind of philosophy that you bring to what they're doing, regardless of the kind of philosophy which lies behind their exertion, in the end, it is pointless and it doesn't actually work. And in all cases, they are to be blamed for the way they're acting, because it just doesn't make any sense. So speak the Nigantas, bhikkhus, and because the Nigantas speak thus, these 10 legitimate deductions from the assertions provide grounds for censuring them. Thus, the exertion is fruitless. The striving is fruitless. So that is that is almost like the background to this sutta. That is the setting up an example of how striving does not work, right? So this is the background. And now we move on to the part of the sutta. Well, how does striving actually give fruit? How does it actually work? And obviously, this is the important part. This is just like setting the scene, so to speak. But the important part is, well, how do we actually ensure that we actually do get fruits and results of our striving? And this is what the Buddha is talking about now. So now we're moving on to the Buddhist ideas of what we're supposed to be doing here. And how is exertion fruitful, bhikkhus? How is striving fruitful then? Here, bhikkhus, a bhikkhu is not overwhelmed by suffering and does not overwhelm himself with suffering. I have retranslated this as here, bhikkhus, a bhikkhu does not ensnare himself in suffering. And when he is unensnared, he does not give up the pleasure that accords with the Dhamma, yet he is not infatuated with that pleasure. He knows thus, when I strive with determination, this particular source of suffering fades away in me because of that determined striving. And when I look on with equanimity, this particular source of suffering fades away in me while I develop equanimity. Let's just stop there for a while. So the idea here is that you do not ensnare yourself in suffering. Ensnaring yourself means like you are fettering yourself with suffering, right? And this is the kind of the idea, the Buddhist idea, is that if you suffer too much, this is like the idea of the middle way, and if you suffer too much, you're not going to be able to make progress on the path. You're going to be ensnared, trapped, shackled by the suffering that you are creating for yourself. The mind is not going to be peaceful. The mind is going to be agitated and restless because of that suffering. And it could be argued here that that is part of it. Obviously, this is because we're talking about the Jain ascetics. That's why we're having this particular angle in this sutta here. Then, not having being ensnared or overwhelmed by suffering, he does not give up the pleasure that accords with the Dhamma, right? So, by not being overwhelmed or ensnared by the suffering, instead you move in the direction of pleasure that accords with the Dhamma. And of course, that is all the pleasure that we talk about in Buddhism, the pleasure or the happiness that comes from kindness, morality, generosity, reflection on the characteristics of the Buddha Dhamma Sangha and these kind of things. And of course, the pleasure that comes in meditation practice, the happiness that comes from meditation, all that is the pleasure that accords with the Dhamma. And that, it says here, you should not give it up, right? This is what you should develop. So it is actually very important here to develop the right kind of pleasure. So you can see here that what it's basically saying is that the middle way, this is about the middle way. The middle way is precisely that happiness that comes from the Dhamma, which includes then the samadhi experience, etc. And lastly there, he is not infatuated with that pleasure. So whatever happiness you gain through your practice, you try not to hold on to it too much. Because if you hold on to it too much, it means that you will basically stop yourself from achieving that pleasure again in the future. So you just enjoy the happiness. So there's one interesting here, the other side of the kind of two extremes is not mentioned here. The idea of enjoying sensual pleasures is not actually mentioned, but only the idea of suffering, presumably because we're dealing with the Jains in this case. So that is how you proceed, and this is the next thing then is that he knows thus, when I strive with determination, this particular source of suffering fades away in me because of that determined striving, and when I look on with equanimity, this particular source of suffering fades away in me while I develop equanimity. Right? So these are kind of different ways of dealing with suffering and dealing with the problems in life. So you understand that there are different ways, depending on the type of suffering that you're dealing with, there's different approaches to dealing with different types of suffering here. So what are the approaches here? What is the type of suffering that you deal with through striving in a determined way here? And the type of suffering that we're talking about here is probably like the suffering of ill will, right? If you have ill will, or also the suffering of desire, of craving, whatever it is, the mind being restless and agitated. This is dealt with through determined striving. Yeah. You have to learn to reflect in such a way that you overcome the ill will, right? That you overcome the desire, whatever it is. So you reflect, you learn to understand that there's a danger there. And you reflect in a way to turn the mind in a different direction. That is like the determined striving in this case. That's my take on this anyway. And then there is certain sufferings that you deal with through equanimity. And what kind of suffering is that? Well, for example, if you have pain in the body, right? How can you deal with pain in the body? To be equanimous about it. There's no point in getting angry or upset or whatever. You're just equanimous. You understand that pain in the body is part and parcel of life. You can't do much about that. So you just accept it. And you just kind of say, okay, it's okay. I can't. There's nothing I can do about this anyway. Not much point in getting upset. So I'll just leave it as it is. Or if somebody speaks to you in a bad way, right? You know that this is part of the world. The world is like this. Sometimes you have to hear unpleasant words. So you are equanimous about that. You can't do anything about it. You live in a world where people do and say stupid things sometimes. So you deal with that by being equanimous. You don't actually react to these things. At least one way of looking at those two different ways. You understand that there's different ways of reacting. Sometimes you just have keep your mind in balance. Other times you have to actually learn to think in the right way about these things. He strives with determination in regard to that particular source of suffering, which fades away in him because of that determined striving. And he develops equanimity in regard to that particular source of suffering, which fades away in him while he is developing equanimity. When he strives with determination, such and such a source of suffering fades away in him because of that determined striving. Thus, that suffering is exhausted in him. When he looks on with equanimity, such and such a source of suffering fades away in him when he develops equanimity. Thus, that suffering is exhausted in him. So here is a difference, right, between the Jain path and the Buddhist path. When you do this, there actually is a result. You're applying your mind in the right way, in such a way that it actually does lead to a reduction in the suffering, eventually to a fading away completely. If you keep on practicing for the fading away of ill will and desire, if you do it in the appropriate way, eventually it will disappear. The problem will have gone. In the same way, if you keep on looking at, the bad speech of other people with equanimity, eventually your mind will be settled in that equanimity and it won't be a problem for you anymore. So there actually is a result. You can see that it actually works. And this is kind of the point here. So here are some examples of how this works out. Suppose, bhikkhus, a man loved a woman with his mind bound to her by intense desire and passion. He might see that woman standing with another man, chatting, joking, and laughing. What do you think, bhikkhus? Would not sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair arise in that man when he sees that woman standing with another man, chatting, joking, and laughing? Yes, venerable sir, why is that? Because that man loves that woman with his mind bound by her by intense desire and passion. That is why the suffering, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair would arise in him when he sees her standing with another man, chatting, joking, and laughing. Then because that man might think, I love this woman with my mind bound to her by intense desire and passion. Thus sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair arise in me when I see her standing with another man, chatting, joking, and laughing. What if I were to abandon my desire and lust for that woman? He would abandon his desire and lust for that woman. On a later occasion, he might see that woman stand with another man, chatting, joking, and laughing. What do you think, bhikkhus? Would sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair arise in that man when he sees that woman standing with another man? No, venerable sir. Why is that? Because that man no longer loves that woman. That is why sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair do not arise in him when he sees that woman standing with another man. So it's quite simple, isn't it? When you look at it like that, it's very kind of basic. You just look at your experience and you realize that craving is the problem. And because you realize that craving is the problem, you actually abandon that craving. And once the craving is abandoned, the suffering also disappears as a consequence. So this is kind of the striving that was talked about before, right? You strive. You see that there is a suffering here. So you strive to abandon that desire. That takes a certain amount of striving, a certain amount of effort, a certain amount of wisdom to be able to get rid of that passion and desire you have for this other person. So very, very simple. But of course, the problem with these things is one of the reasons why this is so hard to do sometimes is because often this is the only happiness we have, right? The happiness in life is the happiness of relationships. The happiness is the happiness of good food. The happiness, this is the world we live in. We are immersed, we are submerged in the world of sensuality. Everything we experience all day, all the time, is things coming through our five senses. That's all we know. So if you abandon that, if you let go of all the happiness of the five senses, then you have nothing. And this is why people despair. And that's why they think this kind of teaching is madness, because there is nothing else. And this is, of course, the whole point here of the path of practice, is that you, to be able to let go of the happiness of the world, you have to find another kind of happiness. You have to find something else. You can only let go of these problematic happinesses if you have something more profound. Only then does it actually work, right? And then when you have the happiness in your heart that comes from kindness and goodness, that comes from meditation, then it is possible to give up the happiness of relationships, as which is basically the happiness that is talked about here. And this is how it works out. And otherwise, it looks like complete madness to give up that little happiness that there is in the world. So that is how that works. Okay, so two bhikkhus. When a bhikkhu is not overwhelmed by suffering and does not overwhelm himself with suffering, etc., in that way, that once you then exhaust that suffering by striving in the right way or by looking on with equanimity in the right way, that exertion is fruitful, that striving is fruitful, because it actually does gives rise to the end of a certain amount of suffering and the consequent happiness that comes from that. Does that make sense to people? Is it making sense? Are you happy? Are you going to end all the relationships now? Is that the next step? It is hard, it's very difficult. This idea of sensuality is so deeply entrenched in us that it's actually often very difficult to see the danger in these things, right? Even when you read that paragraph, you think, but you know, there are, you know, sometimes you can find a good relationship that kind of doesn't turn out in this way, and you can deal with that situation. And it's actually very hard to really fully understand the danger in sensuality. And it's something that you need to reflect on again and again to actually start to get your mind around these things. It is not easy. And there are a number of suttas that talk about the danger in sensuality. There's a beautiful sutta in the Majjhima Nikaya 56, the Potalya Sutta, with all the similes for sensual pleasures. And it's actually a very profound and beautiful sutta. And there's also other suttas as well. But it's something you need to reflect on. And it's something that you really only can fully understand once you start to go beyond these things and experiencing something else. Only then can you really understand the danger in these things. And that is what makes it problematic. You can have a glimpse beforehand, but the full understanding only happens once you abandon these things. Ill will is much more easy to understand the problem with ill will. Okay. Wayne, yes.
Achan, when you talk about equanimity, you're talking about fourth jhana, isn't it?
I don't think that's what is meant here.
Not that level?
No, I don't think so. I think what's meant here is like a kind of sense restraint, a sense restraint where the mind is kind of kept at an even balance. There's different types of equanimity. There's equanimity which is kind of the very high equanimity based on the jhanas, and there's also kind of more preliminary worldly kind of equanimity based on the senses.
Thank you.
Dispassion? It is a kind of dispassion, but it's not kind of the full dispassion that you have in the suttas. It's a kind of early kind of, you know, relative balance of the mind. But it's not the full. The full dispassion is like when you give up everything in a sense. But it's a kind of preliminary level of dispassion, I would say. Yeah.
This equanimity here is something that Whirling can understand and relate to as the kind of equanimity that we sometimes might have.
And
I suppose when it comes to the final exhaustion, it's the ultimate equanimity. It comes to the very exhaustion of the suffering. Is that right?
Yes, when you kind of become an arahant, you mean? Is that what you mean?
Or when it comes to develop the proficient in jhana,
that is the real equanimity.
I'm no longer bothered by this anymore. Yeah. This is far away from me.
Yeah. Well, that's obviously the real equanimity. Yeah. This is kind of a preliminary equanimity. Yeah. Yeah. I think the thing about these words, they're just like in English, right? I mean, Pali words also were just words that were used in society at the time. So because of that, they don't have any fixed meaning. And it's depending on how you use them, that's what actually gives them meaning. And often, when the Buddha talks about equanimity, because he is the Buddha, he will talk about a very high level. But it doesn't mean that it cannot be used also in a more ordinary sense. I think this is a case where they're used in a more ordinary sense.
Different members of the audience can relate to it very, very differently?
Yes, I think that's certainly true. We all know to some extent what equanimity means.
Sure.
Sometimes you feel very peaceful, you feel very at ease and very relaxed, and then somebody says something bad to you and you kind of shrug your shoulders. You know,
but that's not a very reliable one.
It's not a very reliable one, but sometimes you have it, right?
Sometimes you have it.
Sure. And you're okay with those things. It just depends on the situation.
Ajahn, there couldn't be some source of suffering that's not exhausted by equanimity. You know, like you've got a broken leg or something or other. You know, that equanimity is not going to fix your broken leg. You know, that's a source of suffering.
But the mental
side might be okay, but not...
Yeah, but that's the point. The point is that the mental side is the one that really matters, right? The mental side is the real problem. And I think this is the thing with all kind of suffering, is that, yes, there is a physical side to the suffering, but the mental side is really the problem. And that's why it hurts so badly, because your mind isn't really dealing with it in the right way. You know, what you think is just the physical side is actually, there's a very large mental component to that which you think is the physical side. So that's why you can't really see the physical side for what it is. Okay. Okay, so here then the Buddha goes on. Again, bhikkhus, a bhikkhu considers thus, while I live according to my pleasure, unwholesome states increase in me and wholesome states diminish. But when I exert myself in what is painful, unwholesome states diminish in me and wholesome states increase. What if I exert myself in what is painful? He exerts himself in what is painful. When he does so, unwholesome states diminish in him and wholesome states increase. At a later time, he does not exert himself in what is painful. Why is that? The purpose for which that bhikkhu exerted himself in what is painful has been achieved. That is why, at a later time, he does not exert himself in what is painful. Remember again, this is one of those things about the Buddhist path. It is not that pain as such is either right or wrong. It is not that happiness as such is either right or wrong. It's not as if neutral feeling as such is either right or wrong. They are right or wrong depending on whether they lead to a positive result, right? It's all pragmatic. Where does it actually lead you? So if there is a certain type of pain that actually leads towards more wholesome states, more mindfulness, more compassion, more kindness, less ill will, less desire, less confusion, well, then it is a certain type of pain that is worthwhile pursuing. And the type of pain that the Buddha often talks about is like the pain that comes from keeping precepts, right? Sometimes you don't want to keep these precepts. You feel, now I really have to lie about something because I'm in a really difficult situation. And sometimes you actually have to say, no, I don't want to lie. I'm gonna follow the precepts instead. And there's certain pain or certain difficulty that comes with being honest at all times. Or there's a certain pain, a difficulty that comes with having to give up alcohol, right? Because all your friends drink or whatever, or there's pressure in your family, whatever it is. There's a certain difficulty that comes with that. There's a certain difficulty with living the monastic life. You can't eat in the evening, right? There's a certain amount of pain that comes with that. So there's always, and this is the point here, is that there are certain pains, certain problems that are worthwhile because they lead to something wholesome. So all you have to do is look at yourself. Look at your mind over the long term. Are you improving in the wholesome and declining in the unwholesome? And if you are, you know that you're on the right track. And that is all that matters. It's a very, very pragmatic teaching. So whatever it is, whether it's happiness, pain or neutral, it depends on what it results that it gives you, or whether it is right or wrong. It is not wrong in its own, on its own, just like for what it is in its own right. So, and this again, of course, harks back to what the Jains were doing before. Well, if that ascetic practice actually leads to good results, well, then maybe it is okay. So that's what's happening here. And then, as you do that, you find that the wholesome states increase and the unwholesome ones diminish. And then after a while, you stop exerting yourself in what is painful because you have achieved your result. So once you kind of get to samadhi, right, you just enter some kind of beautiful state, so samadhi or a jhana state, well, then you don't have to exert yourself so much anymore in overcoming the hindrances that block you to get to that state. Okay. And then, then comes a simile. So suppose, bhikkhus, an arrowsmith were warming and heating an arrow shaft between two flames, making it straight and workable. When the arrow shaft had been warmed and heated between the two flames and had been made straight and workable, then at a later time he would not again warm and heat the arrow shaft and make it straight and workable. Why is that? The purpose for which an arrowsmith had warmed and heated the arrow and made it straight and workable had been achieved. That is why, at a later time, he would not do it again. So, again, so he does all these things. He exerts himself in what is painful. And thus, too, bhikkhus, the exertion is fruitful. The exertion, the striving is fruitful. Because you are actually achieving the purpose. You can see here the distinction here between the kind of the Jain worldview and the Buddhist worldview. The Jain worldview is based on confidence, right? You have a certain doctrine, you have a certain way of looking at the world, and you take it on as an absolute truth. If you do this, you won't suffer in the future, and you take that on as a matter of faith. The Buddhist worldview is more like experientially based. It says, well, you practice in a certain way and you see for yourself whether it actually works. And then when you see for yourself that it actually works, well, then that's how you actually know. So this is, this is the distinction, I think, that is talked about here. Okay. Then we come to the gradual training. And this whole gradual training is then to be inserted here. I just have to let you know it's already 4:10. So if you don't want to hang in here or you have something to do, please feel free to leave at any time if you do so, because I'm going to continue until I finish this sutta probably. It shouldn't be that much longer, but so please feel free to leave any time. Okay, so then comes the gradual training. Again, bhikkhus, here a Tathagata, the Buddha, appears in the world, accomplished, fully awakened. And then you have this whole sequence of what you do on the gradual path, right? You hear the word of the Tathagata, the Buddha, then you, in this particular case, you then ordain, and then you start purifying your virtue, and then you do your sense restraint, and you have the contentment coming in there, and then you have the clear comprehension, right? And then you come to the abandoning of the hindrances. And this is the last part here. He purifies his mind from doubt. That is the abandoning of the five hindrances. And then comes the jhana states. Having thus abandoned these five hindrances, imperfections of the mind that weaken wisdom, quite secluded from sensual objects, secluded from unwholesome qualities, he enters upon and abides in the first jhana, which is accompanied by a applied or applied and sustained by initial and subsequent application of the mind with rapture and pleasure born of seclusion. Thus, too, because the exertion is fruitful, the striving is fruitful. And this is kind of typical in the Buddhist suttas. Whenever you come to the jhanas, that is really the first time that, you know, now it is really coming together, right? Now I'm really gaining the results of this whole practice. You see this again and again in the suttas. You get to this particular point. That's where it starts to say, you have reached the superhuman stage. You have reached the footprint of the Tathagata. You reached the happiness of awakening, right? And here the path is becoming fruitful for the first time. So it's always the same, and it's always about the four jhanas and the three vijjas, the three knowledges, the recollection of past lives and the destruction of the asavas. Then you have the same thing for the second jhana, again bhikkhus, with the stilling of initial and sustained application. That's my translation there. A bhikkhu enters upon and abides in the second jhana, which has confidence and singleness of mind without initial and sustained application, with rapture and pleasure born of stillness or born of samadhi. Thus too, bhikkhus, the exertion is fruitful, the striving is fruitful. Again, bhikkhus, with the fading away as well of rapture, the bhikkhu abides in equanimity and mindful and fully aware, still feeling sukha directly. This is my translation here, instead of with the body, feeling direct pleasure. This is the first time you feel sukha or pleasure without the accompanying piti or rapture. And that's why it is the direct feeling of pleasure. He enters upon and abides in the third jhana, on account of which the noble ones announce he has a pleasant abiding, who has equanimity and is mindful. Thus too, bhikkhus, the exertion is fruitful, the striving is fruitful. Again, bhikkhus, with the abandoning of pleasure and pain, and with the previous abandoning of joy and grief, a bhikkhu enters upon and abides in the fourth jhana, which has neither pain nor pleasure, and purity of mindfulness due to equanimity. Thus too, the exertion is fruitful, the striving is fruitful. Then we have the recollection of the past lives. So when his mind is thus concentrated, he directs it to the knowledge of past lives. And he remembers past lives. And thus too, because the exertion is fruitful, the striving is fruitful. And then he directs it to the knowledge of the passing away and reappearance of beings. This is like kamma. And then he sees how beings are reborn in different locations. And thus too, because the exertion is fruitful, the striving is fruitful. And then at the very end here, he directs it to the knowledge of the destruction of the asavas, the corruptions of the mind. So he understands, as it actually is, this is suffering, this is the origin of suffering, this is the cessation of suffering, this is the way leading to the cessation of suffering. These are the taints. This is the origin of the asavas, or the corruptions. This is the cessation of the corruptions. This is the way leading to the cessation of corruptions. So you are directing the mind to the knowledge of the destruction of the, or the ending of the asavas. What is going on here is that presumably he's just had these insights into past lives. He has seen samsara for what it actually is. He understands the full extent of happiness and suffering in samsara. And then he understands that he wants to get out of this because it is just too much suffering, too many problems. And that is how I understand directing the mind to the knowledge of the destruction of the asavas. Remember that one of the main asavas here is the bhava-asava, right? The asava of existence. So you understand that existence isn't worthwhile anymore. This is what you're seeing here. So once you see that existence isn't worthwhile, that is how you destroy the asava of existence. Because you, by seeing it isn't worthwhile, you destroy the craving of that existence itself. It's a bit unclear from the text itself what it means to direct the mind to that knowledge. it's not entirely clear to me how you would do that, except in this particular way, by seeing the danger, the suffering, and then you destroy the craving as a consequence of that. So, what happens then is that when he knows and sees us, his mind is liberated from the corruption of sensual desire, from the corruption of existence, from the corruption of delusion or ignorance. When it is liberated, there comes the knowledge. It is liberated. He understands birth is destroyed. The holy life has been lived. What had to be done has been done. There is no more coming to any state of being. That's true because the exertion is fruitful. The striving is fruitful. It's kind of an understatement, isn't it? It's fruitful. It's kind of here you have ended all possible suffering and the exertion is fruitful. It's kind of... kind of nice. So there you are. That is basically the Buddha's answer to how the exertion is fruitful, what we should be doing for having full success, and what kind of exertion we should be doing and what we shouldn't be doing, and what fruitfulness truly means. And of course, the whole point here is to contrast this with what the Jains are doing. So, everybody happy with that? Huitong, yeah?
Is this the reason why it is always taught that when we sit, we shouldn't endure too much pain? That a little bit pain is okay, but, you know, not too much, it's taught by many other schools?
Yeah, I would say so, because I think the idea in some of the schools that if you have a lot of pain, that you just kind of observe the pain and you try to get insight, thank you, an understanding of the pain, right? But the Buddha is basically what he's saying here, and this is what he says elsewhere as well, that pain is actually going to be a problem for you rather than actually something which actually gives you in the right direction, because you get ensnared by it. The mind gets trapped by the pain. You're overwhelmed by the pain, basically, and you can't go any further. And you can actually see that. If you have a lot of pain in the body, it's almost like you're attached to it. The mind can't move. You don't really have the ability to move your mind away. The mind automatically goes to the pain, right? And that is a kind of attachment, in a sense. And that is when the pain becomes a problem. If you still have the ability to move your mind, place your attention elsewhere, like the pain is there, but you can still kind of focus on the breath, and the pain is like in the background, it's not really a problem, then it's okay. But if your mind always goes back to the pain and becomes obsessed with the pain, which it tends to do, then it is very problematic.
Because I also remember Ajahn Brahm saying, even if I can endure the pain, that is done through willpower, and the success of which simply sort of reinforced the willpower.
Yeah.
He said that on several occasions.
Okay, yeah.
I was wondering, because it's kind of different from quite many other schools. Not to.
Yeah.
If it's painful, okay, just change.
Well, I think it's good advice, and I like to enjoy my meditation, right? If it takes too much willpower and too much suffering, then it's very easy to give up eventually. And I have met so many people who have given up on meditation because they never got results in the meditation practice, and that is always a serious problem. The potential benefits of meditation practice are so enormous that you want to give it your best shot. You want to give it the possibility of actually getting some good results. And if you go about it the wrong way, you will destroy that potential, right? And this is what is happening here. You're destroying the beautiful potential of the path. So enjoy yourself. We all want to have a good life. We don't want to have a miserable life. There's enough problems already. We don't want to create any more problems. So let's enjoy meditation, And I think it's a very good advice. The insight that you can have into pain by just watching the pain at the superficial level, when mindfulness isn't very strong yet, when the samadhi isn't very strong, it's a very superficial insight anyway. Okay, you can see the pain arising and passing away. So what? It's not going to really do very much for you. So it's much better to just learn how to find stillness, learn how to deal with the mind, work with the mind, first of all, get it still and peaceful. And eventually, maybe when eventually you become very peaceful, then you can go back to watching the pain and get some real insights into it.
Thank you.
Yeah. Yes, sir.
Jean, do I have this right? So in this sutta, the Jains are saying that karma, suffering is a result of past actions.
Yeah.
Buddha says, no, it's combination of past and present.
Yes.
Is that right?
And
then he says that that through exertion and striving, you know, we've got free will, and through those we can end suffering.
Yeah.
And that the way we do it is to practice dispassion or equanimity. Is that the kind of the basis of this sutta? Am I missing something?
It's not just by practicing equanimity. It's by practicing anything which leads to the decline in the bad states of the mind and increase in the good states of the mind. So what the clue here is that you want to increase the good states of the mind are also states that make you happy, right? They go together. Mm. If you feel kind inside, if you feel compassionate, if you feel a sense of peace, these are good states of mind. They are states of mind that also make you happy at the same time. So it's a strange thing. You're undoing things that are a little bit difficult, but in the long run, they give rise to happy states and a decline in the bad states.
Sorry, I'm not quite understanding. Sorry. So you're saying it's not only dispassion, because I kept on sort of the equanimity. It's not just...
Not just equanimity, yeah.
He's saying, sorry, say it again, please.
No, it's not just equanimity. It's also the right kind of striving, right? So the right kind of striving is, for example, keeping precepts, right?
That's what I see.
Yeah. Okay. So two things.
Okay.
So you have to know when to apply which one. They are depending on the circumstance, you apply different things.
It's not the striving or exertion to gain equanimity. It's more than that.
Well, that could be part of it.
Yeah.
That could be part of it. There's many things going on at the same time.
Yeah.
So basically what you do, you have to ask yourself, what do I need to do to kind of move forward on the path, right? So you say to yourself, it's very practical. Okay, what is my problem? What is my main defilement? Okay, a lot of people have problem with getting upset every now and again, right? How can I reduce upset in my life? How can I have less ill will? And then you apply some of these wonderful teachings that you actually find in the suttas as well, that counteract getting angry. You learn to have more understanding of people around you. You learn to understand that they are conditioned beings. You learn to focus on the good qualities rather than focusing on the bad qualities. You learn to just do a bit of metta meditation. Metta meditation is just learning how to focus on the goodness in other people. That's what metta meditation is about. You sit down and you think, actually, there's a lot of goodness in this world, right? Every time you open the newspaper, you think everybody's just completely evil in the whole world. That's the feeling you get. But it isn't like that. There's actually a lot of goodness that you don't actually see it until you come to a place like this, the Buddha Society, or you know, a place where good people are, or just ordinary people around that are good. So you learn to focus on the good. And when you focus on the good, that is when it's easy to wish people well and happiness. So this is what it's about. This is what the striving is about, basically.
But in this sutra, he's focusing more on equanimity. Is that what I'm reading? Or?
Not necessarily. He's just saying that, well, there's two different ways of doing it. One is striving, one is equanimity. He's not saying that one is more important than the other. He's just saying that these are two different methods and they have to be applied at the right time. Yeah.
Thank you.
Okay. Okay, so now we come to the end of the sutta. And the Buddha says the following. So the Tathagata speaks, bhikkhus. And because the Tathagata speaks thus, there are 10 legitimate grounds for praising him. If the pleasure and pain that beings feel are caused by what was done in the past, then the Tathagata surely must have done good deeds in the past, since he now feels such taintless, pleasant feelings. So the Buddha is saying, well, I've gotten to this state where all I feel is pretty much bliss, right? This taintless, pleasant feelings. So if that was caused by what I did in the past, then surely I must have done the right thing here. If the pleasure and pain that beings feel are caused by the creative act of a supreme god, then the Tathagata surely must have been created by a good supreme god, since he now feels such taintless, pleasant feelings. If the pleasure and pain that beings feel are caused by circumstance and nature, then the Tathagata surely must have good luck, since he now feels such taintless pleasant feelings. If the pleasure and pain that beings feel are caused by class, then the Tathagata surely must belong to a good class, since he now feels such taintless pleasant feelings. If the pleasure and pain that beings feel are caused by exertion here and now, then the Tathagata surely must strive well, since here and now he feels such taintless pleasant feeling. If the pleasure and pain of beings feel are caused by what was done in the past, then the Tathagata is to be praised. If not, he is still to be praised. Right? So regardless, either way, he is to be praised, because regardless, he has succeeded, and he has he has succeeded on the path, or he has achieved what beings want to achieve, which is happiness. If the pleasure and pain that beings feel are caused by a creative act of a supreme God, then the Tathagata is to be praised. If not, he is still to be praised. If the pleasure and pain that beings feel are caused by chance, then the Tathagata is to be praised. If not, he is still to be praised. If the pleasure and pain that beings feel are caused by class, then the Tathagata is to be praised. If not, he is still to be praised. If the pleasure and pain that beings feel are caused by exertion here and now, then the Tathagata is to be praised. If not, then the Tathagata is still to be praised. So the Tathagata speaks, bhikkhus, and because the Tathagata speaks thus, there are these 10 legitimate grounds for praising him. So the point here is that, again, it doesn't really matter what kind of outlook you have. Your philosophical background, your kind of world view is really irrelevant. Regardless of the world view you have, the Tathagata has achieved what human beings want to achieve, right? Which is the ending of suffering, and which is the happiness here and now in this very life. So regardless of your background, it is what he has done is the right thing, or he has achieved what everybody wants to achieve, basically. That is what the Blessed One said. The bhikkhus were satisfied and delighted in the Blessed One's words. Very good. So that is the Buddha and the Jains and the one of the things that sometimes might surprise people sometimes is that the Buddha, he seems to be basically, he's criticizing the Jain view, right? And of course that is acceptable. The Buddha often says that those things that should be criticized, they need to be criticized. And those things that should be praised need to be praised. So you have to kind of clarify these things for people, otherwise they're just confused. As long as you do the criticism in the right way, with the right intention, then it is a good thing to do to make it clear to people what is happening here. Okay, any last questions? John? Friday night's talk. okay.
You stressed a lot that the Buddha said to for the monks to train, or the bhikkhunis or the bhikkhus to train in the forest.
Yeah.
But what happens where there's no forest, like in Tibet and other places like that?
Okay.
Because the Buddha spent most of his time in a monastery and things like that. Yeah.
It's not really. The forest is probably the wrong word. The Pali word is aranya, which means not of the king. It means like wilderness, right? It basically means any area outside of habitation. That's basically what it means. So it means like uninhabited area. So in Tibet, you go into the mountains, right? There are lots of mountains in Tibet, that's for sure. So you go somewhere outside of the capital, outside the village, and far away. And that's really, really the meaning of this. So it doesn't have to be the forest.
It could also be a monastery, couldn't it?
Yeah, I mean, the point of it, it can be a monastery, but, you know, as long as the monastery is kind of, you know, in the wilderness, right, not in the city, that's the idea, Yes?
I just wanted to make a comment. That isn't it interesting in Buddhism that we not only want to reduce our own suffering, but that we would like, as we advance along the path, to reduce everyone's suffering.
Yeah, yeah.
And that everyone feels, including including animal, including all living beings.
Sure.
I guess with the Jains, that wasn't one of their concerns. Would that be correct to suggest that?
I don't know. I think probably that they were also concerned about others. That's probably why they had a teaching, right? If it wasn't concerned about other people suffering, they probably wouldn't have a teaching. The very fact that they have a teaching means that they are concerned about other people as well. So I guess there is probably something there. So I think the idea in Buddhism as well is that the idea of wanting to help others is a positive state of mind, right? It's something that helps you. It's not just that you want to help others for the sake of helping others, but it also advances your own practice at the same time. It's one of the nice definitions that I know about what is a truly kind of spiritual action. And a spiritual action is an action which both leads to your own happiness and also to the happiness of others. That is what almost like a definition of a spiritual thought or a spiritual action or a spiritual speech. If it leads to both benefit, then it is something good. It's kind of selfish. You know, I'm going to be compassionate because it's good for me. But it's not selfish because true compassion isn't selfish, right? So it's not selfish in any ordinary sense of the word. You actually have to, if you want the truest happiness for yourself, you have to abandon the selfishness. If you want to be really selfish, you can't be selfish. Okay. Anybody else want to say anything? Everybody happy? Yeah. Okay. Let's just pay respect to Buddha Dhamma Sangha.